Now, this work, it's not a typical serenade, is it?
No, it's,
in fact, it is
chamber music, but it doesn't feel like it because there are 13 players. So it's much more rich than a lot of regular chamber music, quintets or quartets. It's very fulfilling and grand, so to speak.
And it has two minuets. It has variations. It has a rondo. It has a romance. Richard, what's it like from the oboe standpoint? The oboe is really featured prominently.
Yes, well, this is probably the most enjoyable piece to play in the entire repertoire, as far as I'm concerned. So this is a real treat for me. It's only the second time we've done this piece in this orchestra since I joined in 1977. This piece of music is really in the category of what I call too good. It's so rarefied, and the writing for the wind instruments is so sophisticated, and it's of a great scope, but it's so full of variety and wit and depth of feeling. It's really unique in the whole canon of Western music.
Can you give some examples as to some of the parts that are particularly fun to play?
Oh, yes. Well, there's a set of variations, and it wraps up with two variations. The first one is absolutely sublime, where the oboe gets to float on this sort of magic carpet of clarinets and basset horns undulating and circulating, and it's, you can see it and you can taste it, and the oboe gets to just play this beautiful line. And then it's followed by a variation that's sort of endearingly silly, which sort of, it's an interesting contrast to the one before. So I think of it as a sort of divine laughter or something like that. But the wonderful thing is that, yes, we all get to be singers in this piece. So Ricardo and I are divas. And
sometimes not only on this piece.
And Dan and Paul Demirs on basset horn get to be a tenor and a baritone. And so it's just delightful.
And what were you saying, Ricardo, about being a diva?
Well, a diva in the good sense, I would go for.
Hopefully.
We try. But there is a great deal of singing quality for this piece, and considering that it is in the mid-range or closer to the early output of Mozart, it's actually quite impressive to see how far ahead of the game he was in understanding the woodwind writing, and how he understood not only the techniques for very good register usage of the instruments, but for the expressive capabilities of the instruments. And it is wonderful because there is not one instrument that seems to have any part that seems not to, as we would call, to lie well on the instrument. Yet there are many instances where it lies very well for the opportunity to sing through the instrument.
And Danny, the bassoon. We've talked before about how different composers use the bassoon in different ways. What do you have to say about this particular piece?
Well, given Mozart was not a wind player, he really did understand all these wind instruments very much so. And I think if you think about Mozart, he was one of the only composers who could do it all. I mean, he wrote operas, symphonies, chamber works. Like Wagner was more known for his operas and so forth. But I think it really helped this piece a lot, the fact that he was such a great opera composer. You can hear a lot of opera in this. As Dick was saying, you know, it's almost like characters in a play. Like everyone has a different role and different character. And we have the sopranos and the tenors and the baritone. And definitely Paul is one of the star players on basset horn. And Mozart used that a lot in his Requiem, and he used it in Così fan tutti. But in terms of the bassoon, I mean, he makes a sort of a double agent. Sometimes we're just a nice, beautiful bass line, and then sometimes we get to step up and also be that tenor on the spot.
I understand that the bassoon provides some humor as well.
Yes, and speaking of basset horn, there's a section in this beautiful romance. Suddenly there's this allegretto, and it's with two basset horns and bassoon, and it's a very, it's like kind of odd in the middle of this divine, sublime music, and suddenly it's like his way of sort of making fun of us.
Now, For people who are not familiar with the term basset horn, who can explain that? Ricardo.
Well, the basset horn is actually a clarinet that is in between the bass clarinet and the regular clarinet. It's written a fourth below, so it has a very deep low register, yet it's small enough that it can also sing in the upper register, more similarly to the clarinet. But because of the bore and sizing, it also has a very singing and fragile quality to the sound. It allows for a lot of distinct nuances in articulation, but mainly it projects a gentleness to it. It's not one of the instruments that lends itself to what we would call laying it down and being very boisterous, because the sound would break very, very easily. It's a very delicate sounding instrument.
Why is it called the basset horn?
Basset comes from the French word basset, so it's low. That's technically what it is. So the low clarinet. So Mozart wrote for Anton Schadler for the basset clarinet, his concerto, which is just a clarinet with a low extension, and then what it was called the basset horn, what we call basset horn. But back then it was just called a basset clarinet for all of them because of the extra low register.
So is it not used very often in contemporary or in the standard repertoire?
It's used very little. Besides Mozart, there's Beethoven and Richard Strauss. Yes. And I think that's about it. Mm-hmm. Yes. But Mozart was particularly fond of the instrument, yes. Right? Yes.
And rumor has it that it's called the basset horn because it sounds like a basset hound.
That's very appropriate.
I thought it had a childlike sound. And it had something to do with a bassinet. Actually, George Bernard Shaw's pen name was Corno di Bassetto when he wrote about music. Strangely.
Now, this piece, what was it like to play? Because when you play a symphony, and the whole orchestra is there, and you have a conductor, that's one set of circumstances. And then when you play chamber music with smaller groups and you're listening to each other and you don't have a conductor, this is somewhere in between, is it?
Well, I should say it's a great experience to play it with such a wonderful musician as Mr. Blumstedt, and this is really a repertoire that he clearly loves deeply and has thought a great deal about. So he's has very good suggestions and yet doesn't really get in the way of our own spontaneity.
Also, as he talks about this piece, you see this twinkle in his eye. He's kind of like a child in a candy shop. Mm-hmm.
How does he talk about the piece in terms of getting inside it and understanding it?
Well, he makes suggestions in terms of the gestures, a lot of classical style, the classical music. It's more about gestures than anything else. So he sort of underlines that a lot. He gives us certain ideas. He's encouraging with, I always feel anyone can cue and beat time, but they're here to inspire. And I love his suggestions and his recommendations in terms of just the music making and phrasing and style.
Any particular examples?
Well, there are things in Mozart that can be interpreted many ways, such as grace notes and what we call appoggiaturas. And he's obviously thought about them and why he wants them a certain way. And that makes it easier for us, because otherwise we could have endless discussions about whether it's this length or that length. That's why conductors came into being, I think, actually. It makes things more efficient, and it's really fun. I should say that this piece, I'm reminded of the genius of Mozart, because I went over to the Curtis Institute, and they have a facsimile of the manuscript of this piece, and there it is, and he wrote it out, and there's almost never one mistake or where he would change something or... It's just like it just came right out of him, and it's just like magic.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.